All right, Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast, the comic book podcast with no direction. That's really easy to say sometimes. Anyway, I'm Dr. Morbius slash
from
Al.
From Parts Unknown.
Thank you, from Parts Unknown. And we have Don from Parts Known.
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, God. And we're going to talk about some books we read this week, some cool books we read this week, some interesting books we read this week.
Yeah, it's all those things and more.
Let's talk about the one that I just read the other day, Fatima, by Gilbert Hernandez. I didn't realize that just came out, like, last year.
Yeah, I found one time we were up at Yancey Street, up at Port Ritchie, and they had a 50-cent box, and the first issue was in there. You know, Gilbert Hernandez is always doing work with Love and Rockets, his brother, but you always see a side work he's doing with Dark Horse, which I think this was Dark Horse.
It is Dark Horse, yeah.
But it was basically on the cover. It was a woman with some type of a gun shooting zombies, which is a popular subject these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Gilbert Hernandez. All right, I'll try it, 50 cents. And sometimes the side work, the solo work, isn't as robust and lavish as what he does with his brother in Love and Rockets. And I read the first issue, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's kind of light compared to his other work. But it's not really quite what I was expecting. I thought I'd like to read more. Well, I found the other four issues of it. And it is lighter than the work, but it was a quick read, but it was a really fun read. And it was a different take on the whole zombie thing that I've read before.
Yeah, I was surprised it was about zombies, but I guess these days, you know, with the popularity of Walking Dead, a lot of people are, you know, they might not be exploiting the subject, but since it's probably a popular subject among people, they just have their take on it. And it's a different take.
Yeah, it's much different. It starts out, this girl, Fatima, is working for what they call it, the science, it was some type of a science police organization.
Yeah. And she was like, she was harvested or something, right? She wasn't born.
Yeah, she was born in a hatchery.
Yeah, this is the future, obviously.
And I think you find that out in the third issue. But she's working for this police organization, and they have different chambers, you know, where there are scientists working and secretive, and she basically goes out and enforces things. And what happens is they develop a drug, and they take this middle-aged man, and the way Gilbert draws, it's just a typical guy like everybody in that age, where he doesn't really do much. He just kind of works and watches TV at home. And he's just kind of tired looking, a little haggard and humped over and no interest. And they developed this drug and they gave it to him. And they're observing him behind, you know, a plate glass window. And the next panel it talked about, he immediately got up and started running, like, you know, 11 miles. And it was the same guy, but he looked a little younger and a little fitter. I guess it'd be like if you get a testosterone shot or something. But he started running laps, and they said it was just impressive, the change. And then he started writing or reading or something. And then he cooked some kind of gourmet meal. And basically, the drug was supposed to make you, you know, a better human being. And then before the day was over, he started, you know, coming apart. And he basically turned into a zombie. And at the end of the day, they had to kill him.
Yeah. In the usual way, with a bullet in the head. Which I guess that's the as far as, like, you know, and on all the medias, that's the accepted form of zombie killing.
Night of
the
Living Dead.
Night of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead, Walking Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead. It's like the bullet in the brain does the trick. So, he's following in those footsteps, but the fact that it was a drug, you know, created by the government. Okay, I could, you know, that's probably falling in line with stuff that might maybe in The Walking Dead might. I think they hinted at something like that too in one of the early episodes, that the government was involved in some kind of a drug thing.
Well, that's how I took it. There's something to do with the government's trying to curtail it. In Fatima, what happened, or Fatima? I don't know how you say
Fatima.
Fatima. But it got out in the streets, and dealers were selling it as a drug called Spin.
Kind of like ecstasy or something.
And they said they found out somebody that worked in that science center, you know, snuck it under the table and got it out there, and they couldn't curtail it. And it just goes from there. Basically, they're killing half the human race. The human race is turning to zombies right and left. And then it took some major turns towards the end.
Yeah, it got real weird towards the end. Like the hatchery, like the monsters that impregnate them, and that was like totally, you know, spoiler alert. But that was totally uncalled for there.
Yeah, well, that's one thing, Gilbert. He's not afraid to try things out, and I always found him really clever. And it wasn't, you know, when you'd read things in the 70s in heavy metal and you see this creature on woman action, it was just horrifying and really disturbing. This one, it is, but, and I hate to say this, it's kind of fun. You know, it's like a lighthearted look.
Well, that's because his art's like that.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, it could have been in a Richie Rich or Archie comic book. I mean, it would never be, but it was kind of the same type of thing, even though they're horrifying things. But he brought up, you know, in life, you don't know what's going to happen next sometimes. You might think you do, but it takes turns. And you think, I never would have thought of that. But sometimes, even if you wouldn't have thought of it, it would make sense. And there was all these things. They put them in a chamber. They were supposed to sleep for 100 years and see what happened to the human race. And they ended up waking up in 7 years. And that's where the whole monster impregnation. And they kind of find out, with what's left of the human race, some of the humans were already dealing with these zombie humans and screwing everybody over.
Yeah.
And it just kept going from there. Not spoiling anything else, the ending, it that one really took a turn and surprised me and left me wanting more. It was an ending. You know, I don't know if Gilbert's ever going to go back to this. He doesn't need to, but when it's finished, oh, wait a minute, I'd like to see what happened. And it's a quick read. I think when I lent them to you, you read them all in one day.
Yeah, I read them all in one day. Yeah.
And he could have, again,
he could have fleshed it out a lot more.
He could have gone on, but from what he did, I really enjoy it, and I'd really recommend it. Well, again, I got Al to read it, so.
Yeah, I mean, I like Gilbert's work. I like the simplicity of it in a lot of ways, and I like the fact that it was an easy read. That it wasn't like just full of all sorts of asides and text. It was just a straight ahead story with like some lot of weird turns. But and you're right. If this would have been done by a heavy metal guy in the 70s, it would have been a lot rougher to deal with. It would probably be a lot more graphic. It would have been drawn a little more realistically, maybe, and tougher to take. Yeah, this does remind me. I didn't even think about it, but it does remind me of a heavy metal story.
Yeah, it has it. This isn't an all-age story.
It doesn't have any warning on it, does it?
No, it doesn't look like a. It, you know, I guess.
Well, the covers are kind of bloody.
Yeah, it wouldn't be something you want to give your kids, but it's not something that, you know, you get discussed if you're reading on the subway. But like I said, it was a great fun story. It'd be worth getting. They did have a thing in it that they were going to get a collection. I guess you're going to get to see some extra pages and stuff. Gilbert did.
What, you mean they're gonna put it in the book form or whatever, graphic form?
Well, that was the plan.
Oh, okay.
Even though I've never seen it anywhere except the first issue in a cutout rack.
Well, what was that one that you showed me that Jaime did, that story about the zombie guy? You sent it to me one time, and it was almost like almost done without words or whatever.
Oh, that was I've never seen that story before. I found it on the internet.
Yeah, that one was really effective because it reminded me of more than this, of a creepy or eerie story or whatever about the zombie guy. And it was like done without words. I'll see if we can find it and post it on there. But it was just kind of like, and it had the good shock ending and the whole nine. Yeah, but it would have fit. I'm really surprised at that he didn't do that for the new Dark Horse Creepy Anthology book. I mean, Gilbert got a story in there, but I think that one that Jaime did was a lot more effective, actually.
I don't know what that story came from or if it was, I thought it was an earlier story.
I don't know if it was or not. I don't think it was, but, you know, but it looked like it was exactly in the style of a Warren magazine or whatever. You know, it was like 7 pages, not much dialogue, and it's just the twist ending at the end or whatever. It was either like a Warren or an EC type story or...
Yeah, I don't know. I remember somebody posted on Facebook and I sent it to you.
We'll investigate it.
But you know, one thing about Fatima, after she woke up after 7 years, she saw somebody talking to a zombie over a TV screen. And she goes, what, a zombie? He goes, no, all the zombies are gone. That's what's left of the human race.
That's pretty disturbing.
And she was surprised that the zombie was talking. And it's funny, when I saw that, it reminded me of the old B-movies I used to see when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It had that quality, because the human race, what was left of them, were zombified humans that were intelligent, could speak. And again, at the whole Fatima, they could make it as a... they could have made it like those old Buster Crab Flash Gordon shows or something, and it would be the same type of thing.
Yeah, his artwork is... He's too much of a cartoonist in a lot of ways to... No, I couldn't say that to emphasize the horror in this, because there are some horrific images in it or whatever, but there were some parts of it where I wish maybe like some more dramatic effects that I think his brother might be better at doing or whatever than he did, you know, to emphasize certain things. But that's not taken away from, like, you know, the disgusting things that happened towards the end during the monsters impregnate and all that. That was pretty wrong, actually.
Well, one thing in comparison to the brothers, Jaime, he has more of a clear line style, which I like. Gilbert, who I like just as much, when he really starts to draw, he has a bit of a creepiness to it. When he really renders things,
he has
more of a horror thing, like tentacles and type stuff. When he does his side work, though, and even once in a while in Love of Rockets, it seems to me like he has so many ideas, and he just jumps around, I guess like Jack Kirby would do. And sometimes I never take it that Gilbert spends that much time with it. When he started doing side work outside of Love and Rockets, he did with his brother Mario. Mario wrote it. It was a strip called Citizen Rex. They did for, I don't know if it was Dark Horse.
Hmm.
But I really enjoyed it. But Gilbert drew it, and I love Gilbert's artwork, but in this case... He could have done more with it. He could have thought more of the spaceships and some of the flying cars and stuff he had done in that strip. It was a future strip. It was a neat idea, but it just seemed like he kind of laid line to paper kind of quick without a lot of thought. Gilbert did another series for Dark Horse called Speak of the Devil. And I got the first few issues. It was a 6-issue miniseries, and it was basically talking about a teenage girl whose father... had married or was going to marry this, you know, woman besides her mother. And she was dressing up like a devil and sneaking around, you know, outside the house and scaring the mother. I guess the girl was a gymnast in high school. And then something happens, and she witnesses something dressed in this devil suit outside the house. And it went on from there. And I thought, well, that's really clever. And then, again, towards the end of it, to me, the story just kind of went sideways and... I don't know. The way I took it was he just kind of got bored with it and just kind of quickly finished it. Fatima, he could have spent a little more time designing things and stuff, but it turns into a shorthand. But again, it's still strong, and it's one of my favorite solo Gilbert works outside of Love and Rockets.
You think it would have worked better as maybe a, instead of a 4-issue series, like maybe less pages and more, you know, and more... You know, because it seemed like things were dragged out a little bit, you know, in my opinion. You know, like, scenes could have been shortened up a little bit, or stuff could have been tightened up a little bit. It almost seems like he moved it into a 4 just to get a 4-issue miniseries out of it.
Oh, I got it. It could have been tightened up. I actually thought each issue was a little too short, because they were 20 pages, and he could have fleshed it out a bit more.
I think so. For a 4-issue miniseries, yeah. Either flesh it out more or tighten it up a little more, one or the other.
I guess I wouldn't have wanted it tightened up, because it would have been too quick. He could have, you know, fleshed it out a little bit more. I liked how it moved quickly. I didn't want him to flesh it out so much. It was so dense that it would be hard to get through, because I liked the rhythm of the story. Again, mine was superficially. I would have liked a little more design work on some of the future devices and stuff.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, yeah. Well, even in his story that he did for Creepy, it was even more simplified than this one.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like you said before, he's got an idea, he goes with it, but he really should take a little more time maybe with it and do a little bit more with it.
Well, a perfect example is, and we talked about this in an earlier show, was Marvel Season, you know, that book he did about the kids. In that case, he works in a, basically, a, the the line weight he uses for the finishes is all pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple style, but yet every character was different. Of course, I understand he was working off the real world. You know,
autobiographical, had, you know, yeah.
All the characters had 60s, you know, clothing and hairstyles, but everybody was unique and different. All the houses and store, you know, shops they went to, everywhere they went, it had a look. I wasn't saying he needed to do anything else. It was just fine the way it was. The story was strong, the artwork was strong. But in this one, I guess the closest comparison I can make was Steve Ditko. If you see earlier Steve Ditko work, especially like his old Doctor Strange stuff, he did
in the
60s
a lot more
for
detail,
Marvel.
A lot more work went into it.
And then when you started seeing Steve Ditko later in life, it just seemed like, you know, it wasn't as much. I know that the term is phoning it in, but it just seemed like he was just putting down what he needed to and just leaving it at that, not thinking about it anymore.
Well, in a way, this is a good topic you just came up with because it gives me something that I've always thought about. In a way, a lot of artists, maybe not all, but a lot of them streamline their style after a while. You know, they start off usually, you know, rough. Then they get into their peak, their tight style, where it's like, you know, wow, this is really... And then after a while, it's like, okay, it's in a way, it's almost like, wow, this is it. This is what I'm good at. This is my peak. And then maybe a little bit of autopilot goes into it after that, you know, because you're already, like, really good at it. So, you know, and I'm thinking of Wally Wood more so than anybody else, you know, because his stuff in the early stuff was kind of rough. Then we got the EC, it got really great, but it was very cluttered, you know what I mean? There was a lot of detail in the background and a lot of machinery and everything. There was no, almost like no dead space, but it was well done. And as the years went on, like in the 60s, his style simplified, but it worked because he knew what to leave in and what not to. But then after a while, it just kind of became like, well, he got ill after that, so I shouldn't really use his example at that point, but you know, it got to the point where it was just like, okay, well, I'm just going to do like a blocked out drawing and then I'll just finish it up, you know what I mean? Because I'll give it my Ditko style or my Wood style.
Right.
It almost seems like instead of putting the work in the beginning of it and tightening it up, they do the basics, then they add their style afterwards, and then sometimes that becomes not as good as it used to be, you know. And I've seen that before, and I know what that's all about, you know.
Well, that was an issue with Wally Wood, was when he started doing that work for DC in the early 70s, and seeing this, I bought every one of them. But looking at it, it wasn't as much. It was still good enough, I liked it.
It was, yeah, it was.
But he was basically just doing what he needed to do, and that was it.
He made it look like Wally Wood.
And it wasn't his best work, but you can see he was just kind of, yeah, I guess that's an issue if you have the same job for a long time. After a while, you just do what you have to do and no more. There's no more excitement and love to it. And you're right, Wally Wood did have a lot of health issues. I know towards the end he lost sight in one eye and started losing depth.
Yeah, and his drawings weren't that good anymore. Actually.
And
then he started doing all the dirty stuff that was terrible. And
yeah,
Ditko to me was pretty good up until like the 80s maybe, when it was in his drawing style started to go downhill. But I saw some layouts that he did when he was doing ROM towards the end of that run of Marvel, and I think it was Butch Geis who had some of the layouts, and he had Xeroxes of it. And all he was basically doing was giving them, like, you know, simplistic drawings, and then everybody, it was up to the inker to, like, flesh it out, because there was a run there of ROM, which Ditko did, where it was like Geis inked one, I think Bob Layton inked one, I think Leolola inked one, Rubenstein, and, you know, everybody was like, you know, oh yeah, I want to ink Ditko, you know, that's great or whatever, and he was just kind of doing, I mean, he was getting paid that it was a pencil, but he was really just doing layouts. So I'm sure that's what he was giving himself to work with, is what I'm trying to say, you know. It was like, he would just do himself layouts, and then when he was done with the story, then he would just Ditko, make it into Ditko or whatever, and simplify it a lot. And I think that's what Gilbert might be doing a little bit, too.
I think you're right. You know, it's true. I think Ditko, even when he finishes his own work, I think he's basically just laying out. I don't think he...
No.
Because if you look at the early Marvel work, it was nice. And even when he went to DC and started, and he was always creating things. He did the Hawk and the Dove.
Oh, yeah.
He did the Creeper, and they were neat and unique. And when he went to Charlton, and he redid the Blue Beetle.
Yes, and Captain Adam, beautiful.
And The Question.
And The Question, beautiful.
Very strong work. And it wasn't, looking at it, to me, it still didn't stand up as much to the Marvel work. You could already see a bit of a degeneration, but I still loved it.
No, I think the early Charlton stuff for me was just as good as the Marvel stuff for me. I liked it just as well.
I thought it was close, but to me, I didn't find it, but I'm not going to disagree. But it was later on, when he started doing work in the 70s, I used to see some Marvel work he did, and I thought, oh, this is... And, but he did a Daredevil story when Frank Miller and... it was a guy, David Mazzucchelli.
Yeah.
When they finished their run, I don't know who did it, who wrote it, but Steve Ditko penciled it, and somebody else inked it, like Klaus Janson or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a character called Madcap in a Daredevil story, and there was a guy that did, a public access channel news show called Dollar Bill. And I loved it, but you could see it was a Steve Ditko drawn story, but the rendering was completely different. It had
simplistic.
Well, but a roughness to it, like Klaus Janson does.
Klaus Janson has that. Yeah.
I don't know if that was Klaus Janson that finished it, but it had that look to it, and it was wonderful. When I think Jim Shooter, I'm guessing when he started Valiant or Defiant, he brought in Steve Ditko as a penciler of some series. And he hired Steve Laiolola, one of my favorites, as an inker for it. And that's one thing Jim Shooter was talking about was he thinks Steve Laiolola will give Steve Ditko a finish that the fans will like. And I thought, yeah, that's the deal. Steve Ditko's just not putting as much. He's still working.
He's still putting out books, yeah.
I mean, I see him, and like I say, I see the covers of it online. And I'm really surprised. And no offense, because I love him, but a lot of his work looks like it's done by a high school student. You know, he's got that hand lettering and stuff.
He's a 90-year-old guy. He's doing it all on his own. I mean, you know, God.
I respect it.
He might be one of the last guys from that era. John Romita's still around, but he might be one of the last guys from that era that's still doing books.
Well, and one thing, Steve Ditko, when he works, he's saying something. He's saying something.
He's saying something, yeah.
And, you know, he's into that whole objectivism, which, you know, people malign and say things.
Yeah, they malign, they say things, but they all talk about it and they all write about it, so it worked.
Oh, it absolutely works. But the thing is,
whether you agree with it or not.
Whether you agree with it or not, he stood by his guns, and I respect that. It's not like he's selling out or anything. And if one understands, Steve Ditko's living in a YMCA, and nobody knows who he is, and he follows that objectivism to the hilt. He lives it, he believes it, and he's writing about it. And he is saying something, so, you know.
Hey, you know, God bless him. You know, he might be a crazy guy, but, hey, he's one of the greats of all time.
I agree.
Like I said, I'm racking my brain trying to think who's around besides the guys from the Golden Age, but Ditko, John Romita, Russ Heath, there might not be that many. Al Jaffe, who did a lot of work for Mad, there might not be that many. Nick Carty. Is around. There's not many left. So I mean, God, keep putting work out, man. You know,
is Al Jaffe still doing those Mad?
He's still doing those Mad, like pull those things.
The folders things.
Yeah, he's still doing it. I didn't know. I was talking to my friend James today. I didn't think Mad was still published, but it comes out every once in a quarterly. I think.
Yeah, because I know Sergio Organez in an interview, and he was saying that it went from monthly to quarterly, and I guess that's why he started doing that Bongo comic funny.
Yeah.
He started doing more side work, because, you know, it's amazing to me, too, since the 50s, he's still working strong.
And getting back to Gilbert, he's been doing books for 30 years now, so he's like an old-timer, too, in a way.
Both of them, yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, he's still saying something. It's still a fresh approach. Like I said, I love the brothers Hernandez. They're a distinct artist, and they both say different things, but to me they're both strong, and I always put them together as Los Bros. And I love Love and Rockets. I love when they do it together. I also love it when they work apart, and I'm so happy that they're still doing it, and there's so much available.
Is that Love and Rockets still coming out like on a yearly basis? I think
yeah.
I saw it in previews. I actually saw it in previews. I was going to say something to you, but I figured you're just going to find it anyway.
I always get them off an online store.
So they do like a once-a-year
Love
and Rockets graphic novel or whatever.
Yeah.
Where, and then everything else is like side projects for each one.
Yeah, both of them do stuff. Jaime's done, I guess, for the Village Voice or something. He did this for a newspaper. It's in his sketchbook or his artwork book. It was a Color Maggie story. And it was done like a Sunday newspaper page.
Oh, okay. That's
but
cool.
Mostly Gilbert's the one doing most side work. I think everything Jaime does is putting Love and Rockets. And it seems to me like he puts a lot of painstaking work in his artwork and his stories.
All right, cool. All right, break time. So what are we going to do? Are we going to play some music? Or
you got anybody in mind?
Yeah, let's play the Flaming Groovy.
Okay.
Alright, we're back. That was the Flamin' Groovies with Slow Death from the great year of 1972. What great records came out in 1972, Don? Close to the Edge, maybe, by Yes? Or was that 71? I know Exile on Main Street came out in 72.
See, all those records, I think they did come out at the time, but I bought them after years they were
later.
Out for a while. So,
yeah.
72 was a great year for me, but I could tell you what comic books came out that year, but records, I wasn't getting them.
Oh, okay, let's do the comics then. Yeah, now I want the comics.
But, you know, the first thing I'm thinking of was a Gold Key Harlem Globetrotters issue, which I loved. You know, it had a Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
You threw me for a loop on that
But I was getting all those DC 100-page giants, you know.
Yeah, those things were awesome.
I loved. They had the Batman one, which I absolutely loved. They had, I'm trying to think of some of the other. It was, again, mostly just DC.
72, yeah, it was like Shadow was coming out, Swamp Thing. Was Swamp Thing out in 72, I think it was?
I think it was out in 71.
But it went through 72. I think there was like 10 issues that Wrightson did.
Which were awesome, every one of them. But
we should do that for another show, the comics of 72 or 73 or 74.
One of my
favorite
comics I got was the Superboy. Bob Brown was drawing it.
Oh, and Wally Wood Ink, those were amazing.
Those were amazing.
And the Anderson ones were great, too.
But that was in the 60s. But in 72, yeah, Murphy Anderson was the inker of those, and I loved them. And they had the Legion of Superhero backups. And also, Jack Kirby's Fourth World was still going.
Yeah. You still had, like, was Commandy part of the Fourth World?
No, but that was coming out of...
That was a year or two later,
I think that was... Yeah, I think they came out in 73.
And 72 was when Marvel started doing their, one of their, annual glutting of the markets, and that's when all their magazines came out, the Monster magazines, I think, and Savage Tales, and all that stuff started coming out in 72, 73 around.
I thought it was 74.
I think it was earlier than that. I'm pretty sure it was. I'm pretty sure that was when they started glutting the market. Either Dracula Lives or Savage Tales or...
I rarely read Marvels. If somebody would give me a pile, there'd be Marvels in it. You know, or if somebody had Marvels, I'd read them. Like I said, at that point, very rarely. I see a Marvel book, I might buy one. But it always irritated me because it was never a complete story. It was always, like, continued from something else, and it didn't finish. And they didn't carry Marvel books at the stores I went to very often. It was all DC and Harvey's and Archie's. So I never really touched them. It was all DC and, Harvey, Gold Key, that kind of stuff. But, heavy DC. I started reading Marvel, and I started in 74.
You were reading DC continuously before that, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then, was that Legion of Superhero days?
Yeah, that came too.
Dave Cockrum?
Well,
or was it pre-Cockrum?
Cockrum started doing everything. He started them in 72 with Murphy Anderson. But they were sporadic once in a while, but it was in 73. The end of 73 is when he started doing his own Legion stories where he was inking and, penciling and inking, which were awesome. But before that, they were always showing Legion reprints in the back of Superboy, which I loved.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about those.
It's kind of strange. It was a dorky idea, honestly. I love them. As a kid, there was just nothing better. And you look back, with any comic book, you could just shoot holes in any kind of concept, saying it's a stupid and dorky. But when you're a kid reading them, it's just nothing but thrills,
Okay, we just stopped there for a second to check things out. And, Savage Tales was 71 it came out, and then it went from 70... I think the first issue came out, and maybe a second issue came out. It started in 71, and then went through 75. Dracula Lives was 73.
Yeah, I remember most of those magazines appeared, like, at the end of 73 and 74. That's when they were just all over the market. I never really noticed them before.
Yeah, well, we talked about it before. You had to go to different places to find them. Like, sometimes the 7-Elevens wouldn't carry them, so you had to go to either drugstores or newsstands or different convenience store besides 7-Eleven to find that kind of stuff.
Well, and every convenience store you saw had a different, some different comics. That's why, like I said, anytime you had a chance to be at a place, you had to check the comic rack out.
Yeah, it was like I remember driving in with my dad when we were driving somewhere, and whenever I saw like a convenience store, it was like, hey, could you stop for a second? And my dad was nice enough to do it, you know, and I would just come out there with like, you know, a book or two, and it was always great.
But I guess the closest thing I think of now is comic stores. Not all comic stores will carry the same books. And whenever I see a comic store, I have to run in and see, because sometimes a guy might like something like Fatima. I think, well, I'll try this out. And that was the appeal to the comic stores in the beginning. They got all the comics. So you didn't have to go from drugstore to drugstore trying to sort out one issue of something.
Here's the one that I remember. For whatever reason, it always sticks in my mind. I don't know where I was driving, but I was with my dad. And I think we were going to a farm store. Remember farm stores?
Oh, yeah. They still have them around.
Do they really? I thought they were all gone.
There's one in Pinellas Park on 49th Street, and there's another one in Kansas City on 66th Street.
Well, anyway, for those people that remember, farm store was like you drove in and you picked up your dairy out of bread, ice cream, milk.
Same way. And you know, those two stores I mentioned, you're curbside.
Yeah, right. You drove in. So I remember we were going there, and for whatever reason, and I saw the convenience store, so I said, "Right, you stop there." So I went in and I got like an Erie magazine there, and it was
they
like
had magazines too.
Yeah, no. They had a convenience store next door to the farm store. So I went in and got here, and then I just remember afterwards we went to the farm store and we got some milk, and then I got like some chocolate frosted donuts. And my memory was of having that Erie. I'll post the issue cover on it because I know exactly which one it was. Having the Erie, and then going home and having milk and chocolate covered donuts. I, for whatever reason, in 1975, I remember that. I don't know why.
That's not strange because I equate food with comic books. I got like sometimes you get a comic book, you buy a candy bar.
I remember, whenever
I read
or a Slurpee.
Yeah, or Slurpee. And I remember a lot of Jack Kirby's books, like Atlas, you know, stuff he was doing for DC in the 70s, those first issue specials. I remember that's when M&M's had that Marathon bar, the chocolate caramel, foot-long bar.
Yeah.
And some of the Avengers issues I got in the 70s, like Dave Cockrum and Bob Brown did. I was at Stop and Go, and I bought a cellophane pack of bubblegum. It was fruit-flavored bubblegum, like Chiclets. And whenever I see that, I have that taste of that fruit-flavored bubble gum in my
mouth.
That's
amazing, isn't it? I still remember those donuts too. When you said that, they were like the baked donuts. You know, not the the ones that were kind of like they almost were like the plain kind of donut, and the chocolate frosting on it and the milk. It might have been the greatest donut I ever had in my life.
Well,
I don't know. You know?
Yeah, food and comics. I still remember some comics. When I look at, I remember pizza.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Okay, now going back again, we were talking about the top album 72. Well, I just paused it to go and check out, and this is an amazing year. All right, let's just start with The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Which is one of my very favorite albums.
Okay, not only did David Bowie have that one, but he also had Hunky Dory, which is my favorite album that he did.
And that's a good one, too.
The Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, quite possibly the last great album they ever made.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Todd Rundgren's Something Anything, the thing that put him on the map, the double album that he did it all. Lou Reed, Transformer, where he did Walk on the Wild Side. I mean, you know, Bowie was killing this year. He had Hunky Dory, had Ziggy Stardust, and he produced and wrote a lot of Transformer. So, oh my God. Steely Dan, Can't Buy a Thrill, with like Do It Again. Elton John, Honky Chateau. Oh my God, what a great record. One of my favorite bands of all time, kind of unknown in a lot of circles, a cult band, but Big Star's first record came out in 72. One of my favorite records. Mötley Hoople, All the Young Dudes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And then after that is like, yes, Fragile, dude.
Yeah.
Deep Purple, Machine Head. Smoke on the Water. Let's see.
I remember hearing on the radio all the time. But I just wasn't buying the records at the time.
Edgar Winter Group, they only come out in that with Frankenstein. Oh my God.
That's one of my favorites. They had Free Ride as well.
Oh.
Yeah, that I love that band. I love that album. And I've got it. But a lot of these albums, I didn't start buying until like 78, 79, 80. Mötley Hoople, I never heard of.
All the Young Dudes, great record.
Great song.
Bowie wrote it.
A guy was playing a tape player in art class. I was in the studio working. And I said, who is this, Martha Hoople? You know, you might as well just say, hoo, hoo, hoo. You know, I had no idea. And then he said, what was that singer's name? Ian
Hunter.
See, Ian Hunter had a solo album out that year. Had kind of a whiny song. And when I said, I never heard of these guys, have you ever heard of Ian Hunter? Yeah, he was the singer of it. Which now, like I said, Ian Hunter's forgotten, but I do know who Martha Hoople is, and I've heard the songs.
That's it. Carly Simon, No Secrets, with Anticipation.
Yeah.
I think that's the one that's on.
Well, that one, I remember that album cover. Every store I went to, they had it. I didn't know who she was, but I remember
or
that.
You're So Vain, one of those two or whatever. The first Paul Simon came out that year. Wow, amazing. Alice Cooper, School's Out, one of the greatest anthems of all time. Let's see, what else we got here? Seals and Crofts, Summer Breeze. All right, you know. But I do like that song, Summer
Still
Breeze. And, God, I'll just stop there. This is a great year for music, okay? There's a lot more, too, like Stevie Wonder, Talking Book, and...
awesome.
And stuff. And Al Green, I'm Still in Love With You, his first really great album. Randy Newman, Sail Away. First Eagles, anyway, a great year in record sales. Now that we did our musical interlude or whatever, go ahead.
One thing on that, I remember I moved here to Florida in 87, and the newspaper, this guy wrote up about... When he remembers the 70s, all he sees is this blur of polyester. And he's basically talking about what a bad time it was. And
not at all.
I remember I was at work, and this one guy had made a comment. He said, yeah, I think people look back on the 70s as the ugly decade.
Oh, God.
Well, that was the popular concern. But then
maybe in the 80s it was.
It was. But then somebody stepped in one time and says, more fantastic music came out in the 70s than any other time. But when you think of the 70s, you always remember the manufactured bands and the disco. And when I say that, there's a lot of bands. My wife loves ABBA, you know.
I like ABBA also.
And there's some songs they did that I liked. I just got tired of it fast. But, you know, in the disco, I wasn't a huge disco fan. I guess the problem with that music was it was meant to play in the clubs with a great sound system.
Oh, hell yeah.
And the problem was they started playing over the AM radio, and it was just monotonous, and you just got tired of it, and it wasn't played where it was supposed, what it was made for.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing about disco was after that, drums started sounding a lot better on all the rock albums.
They
figured out how to record it. So
yep, they sure did.
Even
good
if
point.
You hated disco, there was great things about it.
Great point. And then, and at the time I hated it, now... I just kind of see it as just another, you know, like an R&B kind of thing, but maybe more, you know, more syncopated, I guess, what the beat was.
Well,
it was
more like Latin music.
In a way, in a lot of ways,
yeah. It was like Latin music without the really great electric piano.
Yeah, right, and all the congas and all that stuff. It was like a more of a syncopated, simplistic Santana or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, not really, but yeah, whatever. You know. Anyway, let's go back to the comic books and talk about these things that I got here, which I don't know if we've talked about before. But
well, we're talking in the past, but I certainly don't mind talking. Al just brought in a stack of the tabloid-sized...
More of the Treasury edition.
Yeah, DC called them collector's editions, I think, and Marvel called them the Treasury editions.
Yeah,
limited collector's edition was what DC called them.
Right.
They were tabloid-sized. And they were, DC's were a dollar, and then I guess DC had them out for a year and a half, and then Marvel started putting out the Treasury editions, and Marvel's was a dollar and a half. And I'm telling you, these things were far beyond fantastic. Sometimes it was new material, but most time it was just reprints, but the covers were always new, and they were fantastic. And if you went to any convenience store, they had them on the counter by the clerk, and DC would have two. I remember they have like Shazam and Tarzan.
Yeah.
And you know, for a dollar, you had this great big giant comic book, and you had stories that you never seen. And DC didn't really tell you about them, but the Marvel Treasury editions, it was almost like a museum between two covers, because they'd have an introduction. They would talk about it. The first one Marvel put out was the Spider-Man, which I thought was just far beyond awesome.
This one right here?
Yeah, it has my favorite Romita cover on it, the Spectacular Spider-Man. But you open it up, and it has a two-page spread that looks like a Daily Bugle newspaper, and it has introduces it with Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, The funny thing was, at the time I didn't know, but Steve Ditko didn't like to be photographed. So in the cartoon, I think Marie Severin drew it. It just shows Steve Ditko's feet jumping out the window. Yep. And then it has write-ups about all the artists and writers and pictures of them. And at the time of my life, I had no idea who these sad-looking middle-aged guys were. But like I said, and in each story they told you, you know, Steve Ditko, the original artist of it. And you had a page of John Buscema. It showed a Gil Kane story. It had a John Romita story. And it had seminal moments in Spider-Man's life. I just think that was the greatest. These are great, too, because, you know, when kids would go to your birthday party, the parents would always get you these comics. They were, you know, not expensive, but to me, they were a treasure. And I still got several of them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the one of the things that I remember about these, and it was mostly, well, I remember buying the Muhammad Ali one, Muhammad Ali versus Superman, at the 7-Eleven, and that was a cool thing because it was all Neil Adams, who hadn't done like a complete comic book in a while, and he came back to do that. And I just remembered it was just like one of the coolest things to get. That was one of the few that I remember buying at a store. The rest of these I ended up getting at comic shops in the 50-cent bins or whatever. You know, there wasn't that many of them. But the other thing about the DC ones that always cracked me up is when I used to work at the a comic book shop. People would call you up because DC, for the, I think one of the early ones, they reprinted the first, they reprinted Detective 27 and Action 1 as large size treasuries.
Yeah, which I had every one of those.
And all the time people would come in, or not come in, but call and goes, hey, how much is the first appearance of Batman worth? And I'm going like, oh, like, I don't know, $5,000 or $10,000 or something. He goes, yeah, I got it. And I go, and of course you'd always go, oh, yeah? How big is the book? Oh, it's really big. It's bigger than a normal comic book? Oh, yeah, yeah, it's really a normal comic book. I go, no, no, that's a reprint. And I go, what do you mean it's a reprint? This is the original. And I go, no, the original is smaller in size, and it's not a, this, what you bought is a treasury. Oh, but it says yours. I had that conversation at least 10, 15 times with people. They always thought they had like a gold mine, you know.
Yeah, well, what I was talking about, DC put out the first issue of Action Comics, which is the first appearance of Superman. And it's the
and
one,
Detective 27 also.
Yeah, but the first appearance of Superman, he was on the cover, you know, with a green car over his head smashing and people running away.
Oh, God.
But it had a gold cover. In the middle, the very middle of it, it had an image of the comic book with this gold cover around it. And when you opened it up, it was the giant comic book with the entire cover.
Yeah,
intact.
The original book. Yeah.
And again, it was a thrill to see because it had all the characters like the Gay Ghost and, you know, every story was like 7 pages.
Yeah.
And there must have been 64 pages inside it. And, you know, it had several different characters. I think Congo Bill was in it.
I don't even remember.
But again, it had the ads and everything. And like I said, this is something from 1938, I think it was, 36 or 38.
Yeah, something around there, yeah.
And, you know, just the advertisements alone, it was a different world. And then the next issue they put out was what Al said, Detective Comics 27, which was the first appearance of Batman. Same thing, but it had a silver cover on it. And again, the thrill, and Batman was just an 8-page story at the beginning with all these other, you know, I remember the first, I don't think it was, I think that was Sensation Comics 1, which is the first
Wonder
appearance
Woman.
Of Wonder Woman. She had a bronze cover.
Uh-huh.
And on that one, I think it had Irwin Hasen's Wildcat.
Probably. Inside. Sounds right, yeah.
And then, like I said, it just kept going. They were putting the first appearance of Flash. They had the first appearance of the Justice Society of America, which I remember really enjoying when I was a kid because it was so dorky. But, yeah, I love those. I had every one of them. Again, when my wife and I got married, we were moving around so much that I sold them.
Aww.
And then later I had regretted it. And some of these, I've got a couple of them again that I already had. And you know, at conventions for, you know, $3, $4, $5, but those first issue ones, they're more money than I'm willing to pay.
You know, what's funny is, like, these things. Well, no, you know which other one I bought at the newsstand? Captain America's Bicentennial Battles, because that's still, to this day, is one of my favorite Jack Kirby stories. That was inked by Barry Smith.
Well, see, I never bought that one.
That's so awesome.
If you lived through 1976, you grew to just be sick and tired of the bicentennial. And so you see a comic says Captain America's Bicentennial Battles, and I didn't like the cover. It was Jack Kirby drew it, but I don't know.
Awesome.
It just irritated me. But I've seen it since, and a friend of mine says exactly what you say word for word, that it was a thrill.
You've never seen that story? The one
yeah,
that
I have seen
oh, you
it
do
since.
Have it. Oh, it's
I don't
beautiful.
Have it, but
you have to have it. You must have
but,
that book.
Barry Smith inked Jack Kirby in one story, and it's staggering. And I never would have thought that Barry Smith would look good over Jack Kirby, but I was wrong. And a couple of other guys inked two other stories. It was three
Frank
stories.
Frank Iacocca inked most of it, and it was okay. It was all right, but it just paled in comparison to this beautiful thing that Barry Smith, because
yeah.
Barry Smith started out as a Kirby clone, kind right. of, when he moved over here from England
yeah,
to Marvel.
He started out at Marvel more of the Kirby clone, and then he reached that pre-Rap
was Conan.
You know,
was Conan he changed, but when he went and got Kirby, it was almost like the guy put everything he had into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you could see that. He drew every little single speck of everything. It was phenomenal work.
You know, it was like, I mean, as far as inkers on Kirby, it might be my favorite thing that an inker did on Kirby. I mean, I love the Wally Wood stuff. I loved it when Al Williamson inked Kirby, and of course Joe Sinnott.
That's
and
my
Chick,
favorite.
Chick Stone, and, you know, everybody else, but that one segment, because it's a segment, it's not a story, it's a part one of the thing. That might be my favorite inks over Kirby of all time, because when I bought it back then, I was just like, because not only was it beautifully inked, but it was an oversized book, so you got to see all the detail that sometimes in a small book you'd lose out, and it was like, it was detailed to the max, so it was like, holy crap.
Yeah, that was original material made for that format of a book.
And yeah, that one I do remember buying off the stands, and I think I may have even got, now that I think about it, maybe some of the DC Tarzan ones or whatever with that really nice Joe Kubert art on them.
Yeah, I think one of them had a Jesse Marsh newspaper.
I think it was Hal Foster.
Oh, Hal Foster.
Hal Foster. And I remember years ago, one that I always wanted, and I got from some news from comic shop, was the one where they reprinted the Superman Racing the Flash story. I always liked those. You know, I was like, who will win in this race?
Those were fun as a kid.
Yeah, and it was always a tie or something, if I remember correctly.
Well, the first one they showed, it was all through TV monitors all around the world. And
yeah.
At the very end, it depends on what monitor angle you're watching. Because on one side, it looked like Flash won, and the other side looked like Superman won. And people were arguing, and the story ended. Reader, what do you think?
Okay,
who won?
Yeah.
And, you know, but as a kid, a thrill. And they redid that several times. You know?
Oh, and then in some of them, I think there was a Flash one that had a little segment that said, Carmen Infantino shows you how to draw the Flash.
Yeah.
And it showed him. And then there's one of them where Alex Toth talked about animation or talked about.
Yeah, and his Super Friends.
And Super Friends.
I never bought them because by that time I didn't care for the Super Friends cartoon anymore. I was in high school.
Ramona.
And, yeah, I did buy the comics, and I found out Ramona Freyden drew them. But the big dollar, limited collector's edition, I never bought. And at work, in 1990, we worked in an advertising place, and there was a comic store advertising. And they sent a giant manila envelope, and they had that treasury edition of the Super Friends. Oh, God, I remember this book. And then I was thumbing through it, and I saw a 12-page story in the back Alex told through. It says, he takes you through the entire process of creating a TV show, an animated TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out, Hanna-Barbera would Xerox it and give it to everyone that walked into that place. This is how you make a show. He showed everything, how you conceptualized it. You did the model sheets. Character design, storyboarding, voice acting, you know, doing all your sounds, editing, filming. He showed the pan and scan. Everything is 12 pages. And
mm-hmm.
I remember at the finish, it shows him carrying a couple of boards, a can of film, and he said, all this to make, to fill one TV hour and one very large film can. And at the bottom, he said, and that's all I've got to say, Alex Toth. To me, that's genius. And I'm hoping on those Alex Toth books that they're putting out right now.
Is the second one out?
Not yet. But the second one's Genius Illustrated, and the third one is supposed to be Genius Animated. And I'm praying to God that they're going to put that story in that book, because I at the time, in 1990, I thought, why didn't I buy this when this was out? It's worth it just for that story.
Now, you bought a modern-day version of the Treasury with that Star Trek thing that IDW put out months ago.
Yeah, John Byrne's some of the Star Trek work, which I never saw. So that's kind of neat. I bought it. It was. Sometimes it could be a mistake because it shows a lot of the flaws, because it's basically the original art size. But some of the older stuff, it's just a thrill to see some of the flaws in the artwork.
Now, of course, IDW, which did publish that large size Treasury thing, I think the modern day equivalent, even though it's not exactly the same thing, they put out these things called the Artist Edition, where it's like they take the original art and they reprint it exactly the way it is. You know, the original page could have blue pencil on it, could have white out on it, but they'll do like a collection of like say Will Eisner, Joe Kubert, Wally Wood, whoever. And they put them out in these large large humongous editions, but, you know, these things are $125 or something like that. So my friend James gets them, even though it's like, you know, putting a dent in his bank account a little bit, not much or whatever. But he says they're like, you know, they're so addictive that he's got to have them now.
Well, my daughter had a heart attack. We were in a store in Oklahoma City, and she saw two of them. One of them was The Spirit, and one of them was one of the Spider-Man books.
Yeah.
And she couldn't see them. They were up at the very top of the shelf. But she fell over and, "Why? Look at those." And I was explaining to her what they were like. And I said, you had mentioned on the Tarzan one that they had, transparency overlay.
Yeah.
And I've never seen it, but I'm told some of them have rubylith overlays.
Probably.
And when I told my daughter, I was trying to explain it, because it amazes me how quickly the world changed and all these things that we knew just vanished overnight, and now they're antiques.
Yeah, with computers,
The computers changed everything, but when I mentioned, I was trying to explain it, because there's people I work with, like Dallas, never heard of rubylith. He doesn't know what it is.
I did something in it early, like in the late 90s, but that's all I
did. Yeah, it just went away. Well, it's not cost-effective anymore. And but my daughter knew what it was, because they teach it at school.
They do teach it at school.
Why they teach it now, I don't know. I guess, to me, the close thing you think of is if you go to class to learn how to play music. Now it's just an MP3, but they're showing you how to use a Victrola. But I don't know. I guess it's good to know your roots. But,
I guess so.
But anyway, I'm told, I've never seen, but that they have rubylith and some of those artist editions, and I'd love to have them. I guess, to me, the one complaint I have about these is you have a stack of them. Where do you put them? They take up space, they're big, and it's just if you have a pile of them, it's just a pain. And I'm guessing artist editions, that's another thing, is you're going to have a big pile against your wall, and your wife's going to say, honey,
if you can afford them.
Yeah, and your wife's going to say, honey, what are you going to do with these? They're in the way.
So I guess it's like, according to him, they're so nice that you could actually take them, frame them, and it would look like the exact page.
Yeah, well, the ones I've seen, I can't say enough about them, and I'd love to have some. Sergio Arganez has one at Groove.
He does, huh? Okay.
Which I would just love to see. And the Walt Simonson's Thor was the first one to come out, and it has, I guess, I think it's one or four of his favorite stories. I'm not sure exactly how it works. But they have a Will Eisner one that my daughter saw. And they have a couple of Wally Wood ones.
My friend got an EC one. It had some of the, you know, highlights from EC. So, yeah, these things are amazing. But, that would be, like, sort of the modern-day equivalent of the Treasury if I was stretching, you know, my whatever. You know, if I was trying to find an analogy to what these things are, I would say that, but not really.
But the difference is these were affordable. I mean,
yes,
a comic
yes.
book at the time was still 20 yes. cents, so a dollar is a lot of money, but it was big, and they were thick, and they were nice gifts, because, you know, you go to a kid's birthday party, you always have at the time, it was like a $3 limit or something. You try to get them a game or a toy or a piece of clothing, $3 wasn't much, but you get these comics for, you know, get them two for a couple of bucks. It was a nice gift, and it wasn't breaking the bank. And everybody had one or two of these things. I had a stack.
Yeah, I still do. So, all right, man. Well, let's call it a day. I guess we've done a lot of good stuff. We've talked about a lot. We'll have a lot of images to be posting on the blog for this show. So,
Well, since we've been talking about the 70s and we've been talking about all these great comics and music, I want to finish the show out with the song of my choice.
Yes.
And this isn't from the 70s, but this is Ash, and the song is Kung Fu, which got really popular at that time.
Not Kung Fu Fighting.
No, not Kung Fu Fighting.
Okay, because I could find that one. I might have the 45 of it somewhere.
I hate that song. At the school, you know, we go to tournaments and do forms and fighting, and somebody said, let's get a couple of kids to do a form. Okay. So they did them together in group form. She could play music. And he said, I'll find the music. And he brought in Kung Fu Fighting. And yeah, I guess you could see an age difference, because I walked in hers. Oh, God, I hate this song. And anybody over 30 would walk in. Oh, God, I hate this song. And then if you're younger than 30, kids would be like, oh, I love this song. And it was just so embarrassing. And after the girls won every time. They were good. But every time they finished the thing, the guy said, it just kept getting worse. He goes, all right, now when you finish this, they were doing stick forms, you know, with kicking and stuff. And I said, cross your sticks and yell, Kung Fu Fighting. And oh, God, it just gets worse. And, they did it for 2 years. And then sometimes we test, you know, some women would do it. And he'd jump up. Oh, that's real good. Let's play some Kung Fu Fighting. And, you know, again, if you're over 30.
You'd get sick of
oh,
it.
God, let's don't do that. So. Yeah, it is a funny song. And when I was a kid and that came on, you're jumping up and down like, you know, Kung Fu for most of you. David Carradine was doing that really nice TV series.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, all the fantastic Kung Fu movies from Hong Kong just bursted out in all these neighborhood theaters.
Yeah. You those know, were the days.
They were the days. And it was some of the greatest stuff in the whole planet. Whenever I see one of these movies cheap somewhere, I grab it and watch it. My wife loves them. I think it was a generational thing, but man.
Your wife watches them? Myrna
oh,
watches
yeah.
them?
My wife's whole family watches them. And
that's
here's
awesome.
A strange one. I was wanting to get martial arts when I was a kid. We went to karate school, and it was a Japanese school, and my dad saw a Buddha statue in the lobby. That was the end of it, you know, idolatry. Mary and my wife, whenever Kung Fu show would come on, they'd watch it, and whenever a priest would show up, he'd show his palm, and he'd always say, Lord, I bless you. My wife's parents, all 11 of her brothers and sisters, Buddha bless you. And I thought, man, that's different than my growing up, you know.
Yeah, well.
But yeah, in the Philippines, Kung Fu movies were very popular. And
well, they made them there, too, in the 80s and 70s.
Yeah,
the 80s,
there was some pretty good martial arts
there.
Movies in the Philippines.
Yeah, but, that's a different show.
So anyway. Actually, before we finish, I guess I was doing it premature. Al, where can we find you?
You can find me on Slow Robot A Go-Go, which is on the whole bunch of dorks network kind of things where Two Dimensions at and Bunch of Dorks is at and Slow Robot. So you can find me there. And also on my blog podcast thingy called Destination Nightmare, where you just Google it and you'll find it, and it's all groovy and great.
It's all on the sidebar of our blog.
Yes.
Destination Nightmare is under by these guys, and I can't stress how nice that site is. He covers rock bands. He covers fantastic blue movies. He covers Golden Age comic books, which has been a real education for me.
For me, too.
It's just fantastic. And some of these artists I know as they did later work, but some of the stuff, most of the stuff, I've never seen.
I found from just posting this stuff, I found artists of the past that I like almost as much as artists now, like Matt Baker. I love his work a lot. You know, I mean, some great stuff from back then. It was just, you know what it was back then? You didn't really have much access to it because those books were always expensive and there wasn't reprints. But now there's a lot more access to it, stuff, and people scanning stuff. And
oh, it's a great time now. And, you know, like we were talking about 70s. I guess any time you live, there's great things in every decade. And this one, what I love is just accessibility to all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And if you know somebody like Al, a vague memory in your head, you tell him, the walking encyclopedia jumps in and tells you every detail and gets you a copy of it. It's beautiful.
Another thing, too, that I find interesting is that, like, I guess technically the Golden Age was going on through the early 50s, so I never equated people like Gene Colan and and Nick Carty with Golden Age guys, but there were, you know. I was like, okay, because I've seen Cole and stuff from 50, 51. Nick Carty, I think, was in the 40s. I always remembered him as being, the old Golden Age guys were always like, you know, like Bob Kane,
right,
and, you know, the guys that had, like, sketchier style. I never did realize that these guys did work even in the early 50s or whatever. So it's been kind of an interesting. Gil Kane was even around.
Yeah,
Gil
Kane was the Golden Age, and so was Alex Toth.
Yeah, you know? Alex Toth, too.
And Joe Kubert.
They started out when they were 15 or 16. So, mm-hmm. You know, all that stuff's on there, and it's really cool to take a look at because you'll see the roots of what happened in the Silver Age when in the 50s, where everybody's style kind of developed and changed and, you know, took, you know, fruition, I guess. You know, nowadays you see a lot of artists and, you know, their style's already done, you know, when they're there, you know. Some of them get better, but for the most part, they're like, you know, they're complete artists with everything, you know, all, you know, guns blazing. But all these guys back then, they started out almost primitively, but they really blossomed into amazing guys that set the standard for what the comic books industry became.
Absolutely.
It is, in a way.
Absolutely, and molded everything to what you're seeing today.
Yeah, so...
Anyway, you can find us on iTunes. If you are listening to us on iTunes, please leave us an iTunes review.
Yep.
That would be appreciated.
Yep.
And if you're not on iTunes, you can go to our blog, which you can find at bunchofdorks.com, and then...
Click on the Cyclops.
Click on the Cyclops.
You got me by surprise there. I was doing like a pause. I was kind of like... reflecting into the lights, kind of. Yes, click on that Cyclops.
But everything, if you listen to us on anything like iTunes, you can still go to our blog, bunchofdorks.com, click on the Cyclops, you'll find it. And everything we talk about, we have examples of the cartoonist or covers, and also links that you can find further information on it, which some people really seem to enjoy.
Cool.
And I guess that's about it. Anyway, this is Ash, Kung Fu. And in the meantime,
read more comics.